Where are we?
Well, I think we're somewhere in the underground cabin.
In the great room.
In a mysterious location somewhere in the United States.
Yeah, we can say somewhere in Central California.
California-ish. Okay.
All right.
I'm with you so far.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Glenn Kong Geezer. Glenn Kong Geezer. Did I pronounce it correctly?
If you can say it, you can probably say it better than I can.
Okay, because I remember you were trying to explain to me how to pronounce your name, and it's like, oh, yeah, like King Kong is really old and is a geezer. Kong Geezer. So, but now this is the most documented Ehler structure that I'm aware of. I think there's, you've got so many pictures of this and of the construction of this, that I've not come across anything. Are you aware of anything as documented as much as your home?
Not really, no. I don't know if anybody else has spent this much time, and I do it just to show other people how to do it. You know, I like to share the knowledge.
Right. You've got, so as we're talking about the floors, we're talking about the posts, and we're talking about, like here we're sitting directly below this, this large log span. I know that as I've read, I think you said that, how many pages is that thread? Like 100 and so?
Well, we've continued it on kind of as a blog to keep people interested. So we do have, there's 161 or more pages right now, I believe. And so we keep the topic going just so that when people come in with questions about this type of structure, we're going to be there to answer them, you know.
This is at countryplans.com, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, and so now I've been out there several times, and I know I've looked at that big thread that is this place that you have out there, and it's really incredible. In fact, I got to the point where I was getting on to page 70. I would just go to the next page and scroll through just to look at the pictures, and then I'd go to the next page, look at the pictures, go to the next page, look at the pictures, and because after a while, there's just so many pages. But and then it's like it's amazing the chronological order. And I remember like two whole pages, and then there's like a good 20 posts per page. Is that right?
Yeah, probably. I think if you print it out, each page might be like 10 pages. I don't know.
So it's I remember then it's like there's this point in time where a fire truck came up here, and you've got all these people with fire truck stuff up here and everything.
Yeah,
and so all the firefighters came out. It's like there was nothing was on fire. They just came out because it was cool or something.
No, we had the telegraph fire going in 2008, and actually one group of the firefighters came and stayed here for the night. They were kind of monitoring over the area for more outbreaks in case the cinders came down and started something else on fire. They could run out and put it out.
Okay. So it's not like your place was on fire. It was
no.
There was a fire nearby.
1,500 feet was the nearest. They set back fires from here about 1,500 feet, although it looks like to go around to that area would be 2 or 3 miles here, but walking up the hill is 1,500 feet.
All right. So, and as I go around, it's like this is not a conventional home. It's it can kind of tell that a guy who knows how to build has been adding on. Like, I think you've probably got about 20 additions on your home here. Is that right?
Well,
I just guess. I made that number up.
I don't know about so many additions. Probably really one addition, but it kind of grew. It's kind of an organic house. It grows as you think about it. You know, you don't have a plan that you've got to follow. And, of course, you've got to do that in an area where you can get away with that. But it kind of started, and as I was thinking, I'd read the book and go, oh, wow, I can do this. Mike said I can do this. And then I'd have another idea of my own, or I would get logs that were 33 feet long instead of 8 feet long is what happened one time. And so I go, wow, I can dig under there and make a porch and a restroom on the other side. And so that's how things happened. This room here in particular, we had one level, we call it kind of a studio apartment level, where it has basically everything. We've got one bed, the wood stove. We've got about a 1920 round oak wood stove that we still use. We've got our refrigerators, our kitchen, and everything, so we can use that as a basic living area without having this great room area opened up. If we want to in the winter, we don't have to start as much of a wood fire or anything to warm anything up. But then...
I know one thing. Like, I got up this morning, and I was probably up at about before 7, and I'm walking on your little road there, and I'm thinking, man, it's like not even 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's already past 80 outside, and it's early September, but we happen to be in a warmer spot, and the shape of the land makes it so that the land down below is cooler and we're up a ways, and so where we're at it's quite warm, but here now we're pushing noon and we're inside and it's a comfortable 72 74,
probably a little warmer, maybe 75 or so, but we're in a microclimate here where the cool air comes from the mountains above, settles down into the valleys, and at night it pushes the warm air up here. So in the wintertime, when everybody else is down 20 degrees, we're above 30, above freezing most of the time. Very seldom do we get to freezing here.
And there's all kinds of fascinating things. I mean, there was something, you're pointing out this refrigerator that's like a 1932 refrigerator or
roughly
something like that.
1934 General Electric monitor top.
And it was still running, how old is that? 80 years. It's an 80-year-old refrigerator. And then you were giving me a lesson in refrigerants, which I thought was really fascinating. I mean, first of all, you said that this old refrigerator is more efficient than the very new refrigerator that is like about 6 feet away from that refrigerator. So you got this old tiny refrigerator with a big old cylinder thing on the top, and then you're saying, look at the design of this, it's so much more efficient. And then you're grilling me on like, you know what is the refrigerant that they use in this?
Yeah, sulfur dioxide in the old ones. If you get a whiff of it, it'd probably put you out. But the sulfur dioxide is very efficient. The monitor top refrigerator has all the works on the top, and basically it's like sitting a motor with a refrigeration unit on the top of a box that's well, well insulated, so much so that this refrigerator runs about 8 minutes out of the hour compared to the modern refrigerators, which many times run around 40 minutes out of the hour. The heat is going up off of the top of that. The cold is going down the way it should be. Modern ones, many times your condenser will be in the walls of the refrigerator, so some of the heat's going out, some of it's going in, till eventually what makes it out has to make it out, and the rest has got to be counteracted by the compressor and pumping. So that's then you get all these different cycles, the air blowers, all these different things going on it. This old simple one just does the basic thing, it makes things cold. And
wow, and then you were telling me about like the I'm not sure very many people know this, but I've known a little bit about that, where it's like they come out with Freon, and they got a patent on their special Freon, and then it's like just about the time the patent runs out, and they say, oh, we've got a brand new Freon 459, which is good for the environment, the old stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to have that banned by the government, so no one will use it because the patent's run out.
Yeah, it's all about making money. The R12 was decent, and actually it got kind of a conspiracy when they first did it. Propane was being used, and propane is a much better refrigerant. It uses about a third of the refrigerant to do the same job. But let's say if you're using it on your modern cars nowadays, who's going to refill your refrigeration in your car for 50 cents?
Yeah, when they can do it for $200.
Yeah, $200 or more, yeah.
Should I sell them the $200 stuff, or should I sell them the 50 cent stuff?
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay, then, so we get back to the ozone layer, the R12, that just happened to cause major problems right at the time that the patent expired. So then we had to go on to 134A, and R12 had to cost $400 for a bottle, and all these things. In the meantime, somebody comes out with a solve the problem thing for the R12. Oh, we got Duracool. That's great. It's I can't remember the name of it, but there's a name that covers all the different gases: propane, butane, isobutane, and stuff, and they say it's 100% this, and if you look up Duracool, you'll find that out. And you look that word up, and you'll find out it covers propane, isobutane, methane, all these different things. So that's what is one of the replacements for R12.
Is CalParts.
Yeah, works just great.
So, so CalParts is an excellent refrigerant.
Apparently, if you liquefy them, I haven't tried it myself.
You haven't tried hooking a pipe up to a cow and give me some of that, and then I'm gonna go run my refrigerator off of your fart.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
but propane you have done.
I use propane, and I call it Duracool, I guess, because Duracool is legal to use. Propane, since it doesn't cost anything, isn't it? It's all about money these days, and that amounts to about everything. The codes, whatever, but. Propane is an excellent refrigerant. I found out about it from a group of General Motors executives who were doing motorhomes and actually discussing cheaper ways of keeping up the refrigeration on their motorhomes, and they knew about this stuff. And I found that on an old forum that used to be all text.
Yeah, that is an old forum.
Yeah.
All right, so back to the Ehlers structure that we're sitting in, and so now I've looked at probably the first 100 pages. I think it's like 140 pages now.
No, there's over 160. It was 161. There's even more than that now. I don't know.
Okay. So I think I only made it up to like, you know, page number 100 or so. And it's like, cause after you look at, well, after you look at 100 pages, it's like, this is big. this isn't just a quick skim. This is going to take a while. But I poured through it. And one of the things I remember seeing going by are some of your thoughts on, because Mike Ehler likes to wrap the bottoms of this post when he puts them in the ground. He likes to wrap those posts in black plastic.
Yeah, I tried that. And fortunately, our ground is so hard here that after 3 or 4 hours of jackhammering each hole out, I only did 3 posts that way. But those are the only 3 that rotted off in the whole structure. I mean, there are some in the older part of the house that I'm going to have to replace or do something a little different one of these days. And it's not like you can't repair it where those 3 posts were. I jacked it up. I actually built steel bases for them to span the hole. But what happened there, the logs were fairly green, less than a year old. Sometimes you'd pick some of them up and water would run out the bottom of them. Put a plastic bag around that and... even though I charred the ends to keep the bugs from eating it, like Mike mentioned, I found out that plastic bag makes a nice terrarium, and it causes this stuff to build, grow nice funguses, gigantic termites, big wood-eating worms 3 inches long, stuff like that.
Wow, a little biosystem there. But now you've also played. I saw out in your kitchen there. I saw one post where it was definitely not in the ground, so it was not a post structure, it was above ground.
Yeah, what happened, we were in a big hurry to get the building done before the rains the first year, and that half of it. So I didn't do a lot of grading, I didn't set up my laser or anything, and some of this was actually done with laser, but that post, once I did the grading, turned out to be 6 inches above grade. So that's why that post is actually sitting on the natural soil with no vapor barrier, no nothing except a steel pin going into the ground. There's nothing to protect that post, but because it's 6 inches above grade, the moisture doesn't travel through our clay well here. It takes a long time for it to move through, and if it doesn't get any moisture, then none comes up through it. So that's protected the end of that post, never even rotted a bit. It's totally solid there. One other thing I did just in case, so I'd learned about some the sticks that you put into the post. You can drill a hole, and let's see, I'm trying to think what the name of that stuff is that you put on the wood. It starts with a B.
What is that?
Boogers.
Right. No.
Balloons.
No. No. Now I'm not going to think of it.
Bones.
Yeah, it keeps the bugs out.
Buford.
All right, they make little sticks of it, and you jam it in the bottom, and if it gets wet, it actually migrates through the wood and protects it.
But, some kind of toxic gick.
No, it's something simple. Oh, it's borate.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Borax. Borax.
Borax.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's exactly. I made the suggestion at some point in Permies, where, and I was going to ask you that. And
it works. It is water soluble, so I mean it's not going to be there forever unless you replenish it sometimes. Although we have found that the posts that we put it in have had no problem. The ones that were in the plastic bags did have a problem, but since after that time, as things evolved, I found a different method. My ground is so hard, I've got to use a jackhammer to put a stake in the ground. So I try to get the stake in the ground 18 inches or so into this claystone. I leave about 8 inches sticking up, drill the bottom of the post, and sit it on that. But before I do that, I don't worry too much about how straight the end of the post is cut. I put about 2 inches of fairly dry concrete mix on top of a plastic vapor barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And then drop the post down on top of that, and that conforms to the bottom of the post, gives it a little concrete base to set on. Vapor barrier stops any moisture that might get through from the ground, and then you can work out the rest of the floor later.
So then you're thinking that, like, because your ground, while it's, doesn't have really good wicking ability, it will wick something away from, like, 20 feet out, along the ground in the middle of the house, 20 feet away, there's going to be wet in the wintertime. There's going to be a whole bunch of wet. And then your ground will slowly wick it from there underground to your post.
To where everything dries out. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have two different kinds of clay here. And this is something to keep in mind with any kind of earth building. You'll have an organic clay that may be, parts of the leaves and stuff and whatever, and the top stuff is decomposing on the top of the ground, and the surface soil, it may be a clay soil, that is not what you want generally for building with earth as far as making cob and stuff. You want to get that top layer off and get into the harder layer or the more firm layer that's down under the surface soil. So that's what you use generally to make a 30% clay, 70% sand, or if you've got some aggregate like we do, we use 50% with its own clay stone and stuff in it along with sand to make our earth building formula. Anyway, here, our bottom clay will slowly, very slowly, wick out a little bit of water. The top clays are pretty fast as far as moving it around through. If you've got water down a foot under the surface of the ground where you wet it with the hose, within 2 days the sun will have dried the surface, and this will just move right on up until it's dried it all the way down. So.
All right. So the idea is that you have a hole, and in that hole it's possible that water can wick from 20 feet away to that point and then wick up your post. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to keep it from doing that wicking. You want to stop it before it gets to your wood, and then your wood turns to mush.
Yeah, and so I find that in ours, if you get a lot of liquid water up through there that's not just moving through the soil, if water actually gets in there, it's going to actually make a little bathtub there, and you're going to sit in a bucket of water for a long time and cause this rotting and stuff. So what we found out then is to do, and this was something that Mike suggested earlier, an alternative method, is to drive the pin into the ground, put your post on top of the ground. But the thing that's important then is when you're backfilling, you have to have some braces, whether you use 2x4s or whatever, nailed up as X braces, to keep your house from tipping over as you try to equally backfill on both sides of the house at the same time. Come up a foot, a foot, a foot, a foot. And, of course, Mike says not to use machinery, which he's right. Not to use machinery to compact. You do it by hand around there and let nature settle it in. So once you've got earth on both sides, then you can take these braces off. But with your posts above the ground, you don't get the water into the ends. You don't rot them off. We haven't had a problem with that on the ones we've done properly.
So, because like with fence posts, the point of rot is right at the soil line, because you're going to have just this ripe mix of soil microbial agents, those bastards, combined with oxygen and moisture. So then when you get below the soil line, an inch lower, you don't get so much rot. You get a lot of wet down there, but there's not a lot of air down there, so things don't rot near as much.
Right. That's where we found the problem with the ones that were buried. We brought the plastic up to the top. moisture either from the log or however it happened to get over there. It could have been even from an excess rain where I didn't know the gophers rerouted around the cabin here some, so sometimes moisture will move through where we don't know. Somehow, a lot of moisture got into those bags. It may have even come up from the bottom of the logs where we noticed some of the logs will drip moisture when you tip them up endways, stand them up vertically, and the moisture will run out to bottom. If that got into the bottom of the sack, okay, you don't get any rot underneath where there's not enough oxygen, but you do have a supply for water. Moisture will come up to the air through capillary action, or come up through the wood and be right there where all these termites and bugs and rot and mold and fungus and whatever can rot that log off very effectively. It took about 3 years before I noticed the problem. About 5 years I had to fix it.
But now this is also using green wood. So all the posts that you've been put in have been, you've been putting them in green.
Green to semi-green and some dry. We've had both. The green ones, those were green, were, I mean, not real green. They were probably down 6 months or a year even.
Okay. Now, I would, the green stuff's going to shrink a little bit. Now, it seems typically for whatever kind of wood you might be using, typically you see about 7% shrinkage radially and 3% lengthwise. And of course the shrinkage, a lot of it's coming from, a lot of wood when it's green, like fresh cut green, and from that point to the point that it reaches like 10% moisture inside, you've lost like, 3/4 to 80% of the weight has disappeared as water. And so then I think that if you're going to make a post, and you're going to put it in, then a lot of that water is going to end up going down into your post hole. And you kind of need a plan to deal with that.
Yeah, here, even the plastic bag or this clay, when you're into the hard clay here, will hold that water anyway. So there's really no way around that. I think you've got to get it above the ground here and into the pin system for this particular area here. Other areas could be different, where you've got clay soil, gravel soil, or whatever will take that moisture and get it away from the log. Here it won't. It will keep it there. It's like pouring yourself a cup of water, and it's going to be there, you know.
Sit there in that cup of water, yeah.
Yeah.
So and you put some posts in that were dry. You had better success with those?
Well, all the dry posts actually were probably on the pin system, and anything that we've used with the pins driven into the ground, a couple inches of concrete or even just a vapor barrier would do it. If you don't like the concrete, a vapor barrier of plastic over that would pretty well stop the problem, I think. No problem with any of them, no.
So there could be some soils where you don't need the vapor barrier.
Yeah, even this one here, if you get away from the edges of the house and you've kept it dry, if you can keep the water away from the center, it's dry. So,
right.
Well, you see the post that's upstairs standing on that 6-inch stool of clay there. That's dry and never
right.
had a problem.
Well, of course, an angular structure is a pole structure. And which is going to be that you're, because like most structures you see, it's like they're on a foundation, which means they're not, if it's on a foundation, that's not a pole structure. So an angular structure is a pole structure, meaning that the poles are going to go into the ground 2 to 3 feet. Of course, on with ground like yours, which is so near rock, then a foot and a half should be plenty. But basically, it provides a fair amount of the stability, so that way if the top part is moved to the side from the bottom part, that the wood doesn't tip over. So a pole structure doesn't need cross bracing like other structures do.
Yeah, another thing you got to think about is the cross bracing. If you're pivoting on the surface of the ground, like you've got the pin, like I explained, to keep your post from running off, you put the temporary braces in, but again, your bracing is supplied by the soil outside where we've got it. Out here, especially the back side of the bedroom, including over the other side of the house over there,
uh-huh.
The front side of the house here, we've got the big rocks on the porch and stuff that are under the clay oven and stuff. Where we haven't had enough, let's say right here, this functions not only to get rid of the post in the center, but it's also a gigantic diagonal brace. So that stops our forces there, but behind this big tree and stuff, then I've got about 4 or 5 feet that is still braced to the ground there. So your earth, again, provides all your earthquake bracing, whether it's poles buried in the ground or on the pivots, you get the earth up there again to do it. So, and Frank Lloyd Wright's on it, kind of did some of this work in prove that this is a good method for resisting earthquakes.
Well, I think it's been well known for, I don't know, centuries, that a pole structure is cheaper to build, but that there is this problem of the posts rotting.
Yeah.
And so it's like the key is like if to get all of the benefits that you can get from an Ehlers structure, that's like the Achilles heel. In fact, an Ehlers structure, it's resistance against tornadoes and forest fires. It has resistance against like every kind of disaster except for the one, flood.
I've got one other thing to add, and Mike was one that suggested this also, which I talked to him on in some phone conversations and stuff, so you won't always find some of the things I learned from him in the book. And again, you may find it in some of his other writings or talking or something. But Mike suggested, well, if you've got to worry about it, put in French drains. French drains are just gravel-filled trenches, generally with a perforated pipe in them that will drain to the lower side. You've got to get a little ditch out and will drain the water away from your structure. What we found here, we could compact around it. Things sealed off good for 3 or 4 years, but the gophers came back, and gophers like to reroute your water. You can do your best planning, and the gophers are going to say, hey, you know, we want this water out of our house and into yours. So we got to where we were having moisture problems on the floor and stuff. We put in some sumps, and I'm currently partway through putting a permanent French drain draining to the outside. But going back and retrofitting is a little rougher than doing it in the first place. But I knew about it. I didn't have time to do it. So here's what we do.
Have you seen my thread at Permies about French drains?
No, I haven't. I don't get enough time to get around to everything. So.
Oh, I know. And for a while you were out at Permies, and
yeah.
And then but I think your time got spread too thin, and you were spending a lot more time over at Country Plans.
I dropped back and forth, because I started with John at Country Plans in the very early stages of this cabin, and so I'm an administrator there, and that keeps me pretty darn busy.
Yeah. But so I'm not a fan of French drains. I think for 92% of all the places that have installed French drains are stupid. And for 8% of the places where French drains are installed, French drains are smart. So I'm not a fan of French drains. I far prefer, like when Mike does the uphill patio, that you put ditches in that go around the structure to take all any water that might be coming down out. Now of course, Mike's also got his stuff set up in such a way there's still occasionally a ground digging critter that comes through, and Mike actually kind of looks at it like he got a mole once that came through his house, like after he'd been living in it for like 15-17 years, that a mole came in from the outside, and he actually thought that was like a really excellent, awesome thing. Like he looks at it as like a feature, like a sign of approval or something. But I imagine that if he ever got to the point that he was having like 7 or 8 per year, he might change his mind about how much he enjoys moles. But I kind of think about when with the Wafati, which is a design extension of an Ehlers structure, that if you get things to be dry 20 feet in every direction away from your structure,
yeah,
the moles don't like that. Any of the ground digging critters are like, this sucks.
Yeah, you got to stop and think that we also started fairly early, and I didn't know anybody that had done this, so I had nothing to go on. I've learned even then since about Paul Hayes' design, where he does more of what you're talking about, 20 feet out or so.
Right.
And
the passive annual heat storage.
John Hay. And so that's the thing that could have been done better. And then the other thing is I deviated slightly from Mike's design in a way. I got the uphill patio, but I took my cabin and I turned it sideways and kind of changed the drainage to where it's got runoff on two different sides and then down the hill from there. So that probably gives me a few problems that I wouldn't have had if I'd strictly followed Mike's design and kept everything running off to the downhill.
It does seem like a lot of people don't. I mean, I think that the roof design is the most important, and it's like really, if you just follow the roof design, then you get all the perks, everything works out. And it seems like I've heard from so many people that have built an Ehlers structure and are having problems, and it's like every time they have a problem, you'll find that they decided to do something interesting with the roof design. Is that your experience?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the only problems we have. It's where I have a hyperbolic paraboloid roof where part of it drains back toward the center, and that comes off of a corkscrew roof above the bedroom that drains down and around backwards like a corkscrew and meets with the hyperbolic paraboloid, where I've got logs rotating from 8 to 16 over there on a 12-foot axis, and then 16 over there and 8 over here, see? So it's rolling, and I don't know if you noticed it if you're not looking for it, but and then I put a sun scoop on the top so you don't see the roll so much there. You see what I mean?
Right, I see that.
16 feet there roughly and 16 over there, and then 8 feet there and 8 feet here. So where these two came together has been our major problem that we're going to go back through. And Mike, since I started this, has gone to recommending EPDM on the roof. That's a number one recommendation. Super great stuff. Polyethylene is not forgiving. You get a stick or a rock or whatever, and
but it's cheap.
But it's cheap, and I still recommend it for that too, because if you don't have money for EPDM, then by all means use poly and have a house.
Now, I made a suggestion to Mike, and this is one of the things that's different about a Wolfati, where you lay down about a quarter of an inch thick of newspaper, just regular old newspaper, and then put the poly on that, and then another quarter inch of newspaper. And at first he said, no, that's stupid. And then he called me back the next morning, and he said, no, I slept on it, and I got to tell you, I think it's brilliant. I think that's going to even be better than EPDM. And, of course, just a teeny tiny fraction of the cost of EPDM. But I said about, like, you know, I was, because when I talked to Mike the day before, he was like, no, that's stupid. It's like, damn it, Mike. And so I went about and I put it together all these newspaper things demonstrating, and I'm like putting together all these experiments to show Mike how water runs off of newspaper, and and when you get like a quarter of an inch thick, how difficult it is to penetrate newspaper.
Yeah.
So newspaper itself is like, when it's a quarter of an inch thick all laid together, and you pour water on it, it will absorb some, but most of it runs off.
Yeah.
And then you try to like poke holes in it. And it's hard when it's caked together a quarter of an inch thick. It's really, I mean, like it's literally hard.
Yeah.
And so then, and I kind of wonder, could you even do it with just newspapers and not even use any EPDM? I'm sorry, any plastic, any poly. And so I wonder, but I'm not going to try it. But I wonder.
I think if you know about the old sod houses, I don't know. I would wonder, for one thing, we have wood rats outside here. They'll eat through about anything. So they might want to go through and chew their way through the paper if they decide. They live in the ground underneath
right.
piles of wood. The other thing, we probably did a no-no, but we actually used some building paper, which has a little bit of tar paper in it. Or
which is what Mike's original design to use.
Right, and that's where I think I got that. Or just plain tar paper. Is another thing that's, you know, fairly decent stuff, and it will help to protect the poly also.
Right. Not very eco, but, you know, that's what Mike originally used.
Yeah.
I mean, that had to be about 40 years ago now.
It's one more pretty safe thing to use, though. I mean, Jiminy, we had oil coming up in the Middle East before Noah built the Ark, right?
So, all right, I want to go back to talking about using green wood, and so I think that, you know, as I look around at the designs you have, I can see how a lot of your designs are taking into account this wood is going to shrink a little, and then as it shrinks a little, it's like no problem. We're going to totally the designs are set to be okay with that.
Absolutely, that's kind of the beauty of Mike's design is it doesn't care. The dirt that's on the roof is going to fall. The rest of it is that it shrinks. It's not, one thing to keep in mind, and I talked to Mike about this, and he's the one that suggested it. The wood, the boards, if you use wet boards, are going to shrink over the years. Mike said that he over 30 years or so, ended up having a few problems with some dust and stuff coming through as it probably pulled a little bit on his plastic. Maybe his first layer, because Michael has used the two layers of plastic. You know, he had one about 4 inches up above the original one.
Are you one layer or two layers here?
I'm two layers on everything at least.
Yeah.
And now we're going to go with some EPDM over the top. As we get into problem areas, we're going to start fixing them.
Okay.
So one thing that Mike suggested is using the wet wood. It's going to shrink. It's going to leave you a gap. I find typically that the pine sawed on my sawmill, when I've got a damp log, will shrink about 5/8 of an inch per foot of width. So I make shiplaps. So let's say we've got 3/4 to 1 inch boards. I generally find the 3/4 is just fine as far as thickness, so you can save some wood that way. 3/4 thickness boards. I take two skill saws. I've tried routers. I've burned a bunch of them up. I've tried different things. It depends on what kind of equipment you have available, but simplest way is two skill saws or even one if you don't mind resetting. You set the board on edge, make a little vise. You can buy some of these little vise tables or whatever. Get the board on edge, cut about a 7/8 inch slit down the center of the board, and do all your boards, both edges if you want. Stack them again, then pick them up and take the other saw and set it for 7/8 wide but only 3/8 of an inch deep,
mm-hmm.
and you cut that off and you have a little strip of lath, so it's like 1/4 inch by 3/4 wide after you got your saw kerf. So that gives you one half of a shiplap. Flop the board over, and on the opposite side you do the same thing. You have usually your rip guide set up on your saw then, and I find it easiest to use two saws because you're not constantly resetting.
Right.
And then so you make your own shiplap that way. You lap it 7/8, even if it's wet. In a year, year and a half, it's going to be about close to a 3/4 or 5/8 gap, but it'll still be lapped, you know, an 1/8
right.
to 1/4 or better, as you can see in here. You know, some of these were probably partially dry, so they're not all gapped as wide, but
Does look like a pretty unit. It looks like a lot of the stuff that you've cut is about 10-inch plank, 12-inch plank, and you can see gaps. The biggest gap I can see is, like, yeah, pushing 3/4 of an inch. The smallest gaps are, like, about 1/4 of an inch.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and then it's like, you know, another strategy, of course, is for that wood, you could, you know, dry it first and then put it up.
You dry it first and then you'd have no gaps, but then you might be sleeping in a tent in the wintertime with the snow coming down around your feet around here.
It's like you might want to dry it before you start building your ailer structure.
Yeah, you could. If you've got the time, definitely that's the best. If you don't, go ahead on and just do some of the things you need to do to use wet wood.
Now, I was up at Mike's place, I don't know, it was less than a year ago, I think. And he's got his ridgetop house, which he's been working on for years and years and years. And I was up there like 3 years ago looking at it, as well as about a year ago. And it's like he's had to take some of the posts out because during the time that he was working on it, it got rained on and wet and stuff like that. And then, so it's like those poles that were in there
the very problem
rotted.
He talked about, I believe he used the plastic on those. And
yeah.
I don't know if he knows that that's a problem or he thinks it was just from the weather. But I believe it's the same problem I found. The moisture gets behind the plastic and eats the poles away.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think it's something where when you build an ailer structure, and I think when you build anything, really, you want to build it fast. You know, get the roof on it so that way, you know, you're not having rain come into your wood and causing rot. But then, and then the other thing is like, with greenwood, a couple of, you know, notes that maybe not everybody, I imagine everybody listening to this podcast knows, but maybe some don't. One is cut so much easier. Greenwood is just so easy to work with. Greenwood is 5 times heavier. So now you're going to put that log up there and it doesn't look so big, but you're going to need 8 guys.
A remote control crane.
Yeah, exactly. Remote control crane. Not all of us have a remote control crane.
So me.
Yeah, And it's going to be crazy heavy. And then, of course, there's the shrinkage that's going to happen. My numbers are correct. You correct me if I'm wrong. Generally, typically 3% radially. And Let me take it back. It's 3% lengthwise, typically 3% lengthwise, and 7% radially.
I think that works out pretty close to what I figured here, roughly, you know, 5/8 or a little better on a 12-inch wide board.
Right.
So right in there.
Right. And then as you're here, then the wood shrinks, and every once in a while you'll hear the house groan a little bit as it's doing some shrinking.
That's something interesting. If you use the green logs, you're sitting in the living room reading the paper, and all of a sudden you hear a big crack and a snap. The roof didn't just fall down. It's just one of the logs might have split and opened up a quarter inch or so from the stresses, maybe for anywhere from 5 to 20 feet long. And it can do that for up to, I've heard it even 3 years later, and I even hear an occasional one now.
And yet it's all still standing. Ever had anything cave in on you?
No.
Now, I know that when Mike originally wrote the book, he was recommending that the soil on the roof be 3 feet thick, which is, interestingly enough, Sepp Holzer recommends a similar structure. He independently created the same kind of thing, but for animal shelters. So how does it feel living like an animal? But anyway, 1 meter thick, which is slightly more than 3 feet. And now, in more recent years, Mike has modified that to be about 2 feet, and a lot of people have gone even to a foot and a half.
Yeah, the book that I have, as far as I recall from what I read in Mike's book, his tables were designed for 2 foot of earth and a foot of water. So that gives you your 3 feet then probably. But Mike has since, I believe he wrote an addendum in his book on some of the later ones that he recommended dropping it to 18 inches. And I recommend that myself also. Reduce loading because Mike had a certain species of log that he was using. Here I had to use whatever I had. There's lodgepole around here, but it's like in Yosemite Park, and the rangers are really mean up there.
Those bastards. Are they keeping you from some logs?
Oh, yeah.
This is a park, dude. That tree is a national tree.
We own the park.
So we're going to go look at some of those beautiful trees later.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, I always look at the giant sequoias, Mariposa Grove, and I think, man, I could make a lot of lumber out of that.
I imagine we're going to see some trees where it's like, you know what, I could just take a chainsaw and just carve out a house out of the middle of that tree. It'll be one piece of wood.
Yeah, it's been done. Yeah, and another thing, I have my own sawmill, so one of my buddies up here that's been around for years told me, once you have your sawmill, you'll never look at a tree in the same way.
I have a sawmill, so I know what you mean.
Yeah.
All right, so we see above, in fact, I'm not seeing a lot of, like, round wood timber framing joinery. I'm seeing stuff that looks like it's loose, and maybe there's pins and things I can't see. I don't even see bolts holding it together.
Yeah, actually, I believe from Mike Ayler's book, everything is pinned together with rebar. Every log up there has an 18-inch piece of rebar. Rebar is always easy to get, cheap, reasonably cheap anyway, you know, because they make so much of it. So a lot of times you can even find it used. I use an 18-inch ship drill, a ship auger with a heavy-duty drill. I mean a heavy-duty drill. And drill down through the top. If the log is too big, like let's say at the 10-inch log I'm fastening down, I'd like to see about 8 and 8, so I'll go down to the side of the log a little bit, my beam log, and so I can try and get about 8 inches into the beam and into the girder log that's below it. And then if you drill a half-inch hole for a half-inch rebar, you got to remember a rebar is a deformed bar, and it has all the bumps on the outside.
Right.
It's going to take you a 3 or 4 pound sledgehammer and quite a bit of work to drive that down through there. Once you've got 8 inches in the bottom log and 8 inches into the beam log, I have accidentally hooked into one of those with my backhoe when I was doing a little adjusting in the kitchen.
We all take our backhoe into the kitchen to adjust.
Well, there was actually, this was built so I could get the bobcat into here to do some more digging, and I got a bigger bobcat, so that messed that up. But I hooked it with the back of the backhoe, and I lifted the post. I'm talking the big 12-inch post up there.
Uh-huh.
Lifted it out of the ground with the log it was fastened to with one rebar pin in it. So that's how strong everything's fastened together. So everything can
have a good shear strength.
Rock and roll, and the shear strength on that half-inch bar.
Amazing.
60,000 pounds per square inch.
Yeah.
You're going to be a little less than a quarter of that, so you're going to be 10, 12,000 pounds at least anyway.
Yeah. So more than I can lift.
More than the wood can handle.
Yeah.
More
yeah.
than the wood can handle.
Right. Right. So it's gonna be pretty good. All right. So when putting the post in, I think that the optimal route at this point in time is you could consider a little bit of a vapor barrier at the very bottom, a little bit of plastic, but when you refill the packet around the wood. Using a little borax plus maybe a little diatomaceous earth mixed in there.
That could be good for the chewing creatures and stuff. You can get the infill sticks, I think they're called, that you can drill a hole and just stuff one in the bottom of your post if you're worried about it. One other thing I need to bring up, not everybody has soil or claystone that I have.
Right.
That will support 60,000 pounds per square foot or something like that is what I figured it up at, maybe even more.
Yeah.
So if you're in an area where you do not have the soil strength you don't have to get as crazy as the engineers get on a house to protect themselves, but you may end up having to put a little concrete footing under there because these logs, these posts will have around 12,000 to, depends on how crazy you get with the dirt on top, could have 16,000 pounds on one post. So
if your soil's soft, you might be pushing that into the ground.
Soft soil, the ceiling may hit you in the head one of these days, as the thing slowly settles into the ground.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So you may have to do some footing work underneath these, and that's where it's ideal to use the pin and the concrete footing or whatever if you need to then. But you're only using a minimal amount of concrete, so you're not going to break the world, You're not going to kill everybody on Earth.
Right. So dried wood might be superior in a variety of ways to make a tighter structure, but if you have the brain capacity, you could make something where it's like, and we're going to have the expectation that this stuff is going to shrink, and we're going to mitigate that. So, some people dry, some people green, depending on factors.
I was green when I started.
Never mind. Cute. All right.
I try.
So, all right. So much other stuff. Oh, before I forget, let's spend all of a minute and a half talking about the signs on your property, because one of the questions people have about, I want to build a nailer structure because it is the best. And I firmly believe that, I believe the Wolfati is the best, but 80% of the Wolfati design is an nailer structure. And people say, well, what about codes and building codes and the Department of Making You Sad wants to come out and do what they do and they're going to send these people out that, where it's like, I've been instructed to come here and tell you that we don't know what that is, therefore you can't do it. But you've got a solution for that. You're in a county where technically this building is not allowed. Innovation is not allowed. And yet, at the same time, here it is, and you had a very simple, elegant, quick solution, which seems to have worked well so far. How long have you been here? 20 years?
Well, we've been here a little over 10 years.
Yeah. And so far, the Department of Making You Sad has decided to not come here.
They were looking for me, but they got scared and didn't show up.
That's a good sign. So, okay, now you got to spill your secret.
A couple different things, I guess. One thing is I'd like to be in the naval code area, and by that I mean like the Navy. You live in a don't ask, don't tell area. That works out. That's part of it. The other thing is a sign that I have came from www.landrights.com. The no trespassing sign there has a $5,000 land use fee, and that's an important word, land use fee, for any officials that want to come up and violate your civil rights is basically what the laws are based on. He's got the laws and stuff that are on there that they're violating. It makes them personally responsible for it, so the county's going to drop out of there because they don't want to get in the middle of a civil rights lawsuit or anything. How far it'll go, where you're at, whether they will obey the actual laws and your rights remains to be seen. All I know is they don't seem to want to hassle me about it. I know that they know where I'm at because one of the neighbors said they were down there looking for me one day.
But they didn't want to come on your property to come find you.
No, actually, some of the sheriffs during the fire didn't even want to admit they had read my sign because apparently that sign does affect them, and they would have been responsible for the $5,000 land use fee if I wanted to press it.
And the $5,000 doesn't, it's not like you ask for the $5,000 from the Department of Sheriffs.
No.
You ask for the $5,000 from Steve, the deputy that was, you know, on your land.
Violated my rights and trespassed on my property. And even though, let's say his software is a super example of it. Get on your computer. I agree to all these 10,000 pages of stuff. You are legally liable for that. And if he sees this sign that tells him, if you come and harass me, then I'm going to take you to the court for this. You want to take him to small claims court. They willingly passed 7 signs by the time they get to my place. The other thing that's good is the, well, I call it the constitutional no trespassing sign, but also the patent, the land patent. Get your paperwork starting from you, every previous owner, all the way back to the original land patent or homestead given by the federal government. You'll find that your county, in 99% of the cases, doesn't have any ownership rights to your property.
The people making you sad are typically county people.
They're violators, actually, yeah. There's a lady down here that caught one of the sheriffs trespassing for the building department. Big stink about it. He got in big trouble, and sheriff's department backed out of it, does not want anything to do with enforcing building violations or anything anymore since she got after him.
So, because basically somebody could come onto your land, here where you've got this Ehlers structure, and they could say, that's different, and so now I'm going to report it. But then, and then if the Department of Making You Sad says, we got a report, you can say, by whom?
Yeah,
and then
tell,
and then suddenly that person, you might find that a day later that person's like, no, that was a typo. I was never there.
Oh, I've had this stuff happen before when I had to fight with the irrigation district down in Fresno, and I told them that I would get a hold of my environmentalist friends and we would clean up every piece of blacktop they had used in the water holding up their banks from washing away. It's illegal for them to put that in there and pollute the ground. I told them they were polluting my well, my neighbor's well, and a bunch of other people's wells. And so we were going to get together, and we were going to make them clean up every piece of blacktop in every canal in Fresno County. And they said, oh, you know, by the way, I think we can work something out here. Big threats before that, big threats. Attorneys,
yeah.
Everything. Yeah.
Right. I mean, a lot of it is bravado. And they get away with it because nobody makes the
standard.
Nobody
questions them. Question them. You know?
It's a hassle.
Look at your rights. You know, landrights.com. I can't say all this stuff's going to work because you know how everything's, all the laws are ignored by.
Because they've got $10 million worth of attorneys on their.
They've got our money.
Like, but on the other hand, it's like, you know, with a little, if there's a little bit of hassle, it could be like, ah, now we're going to spend $20 million on attorneys. Whereas we only have a budget for 10.
Yeah,
and so it's like, you know what, let's just back out now,
you know?
And then we're gonna try a different sneaky evil route.
Yeah, so I say put the signs up, go ahead and be the aggressor. Put the signs up first and make them wonder if they're going to get in trouble. Maybe they'll just leave you alone, you know. I've got even fire people that were up here that actually blew my sign up to double size. Not my sign, but land rights sign. Blew it up to double size and posted it on his place to keep them out of his place. The sheriffs verified the sign's effective. They didn't want to admit they'd read it, but they knew my name because it was on the sign.
And it does seem like in this podcast, we've had several occasions where we've had examples of like people that were nice and lovely and very friendly people, the government basically comes and harasses them to the tune of tens and twenties and hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines and this, and you have to be our servant for life and only do what we say. But in the meantime, if you have a person that is doing far more in violation, but they are, let's say, cranky or possibly a little crazy and armed up to the teeth, then the government's kind of like, yeah, we've decided to just not pursue that one. And yes, they're doing 10 times more than the easy going. We're going to go after easy prey. And it's kind of like, and it kind of is a way that it kind of works out to be, which is extremely unfortunate. I very much like the idea that lovely, gentle people win and cranky people lose, but yet it kind of seems like the system is set up to go the other way, at least at this point. And so it does seem like, okay, so people say, oh, will it pass code where I am? And it's kind of like, some places I'm sure it will because there's no building codes. And in other places it's kind of like, well, you probably aren't going to get away with building this in town without an engineer. And if you've got a friend that's an engineer, or you know something, but engineering, if you get an engineering sign-off, that could itself be like 10 grand.
The cost is going to go up to 1.5 to 3 times probably the value of a regular house if you have to get codes, inspections, engineers, and stuff involved.
Yeah.
We have a friend that tried to do one their way. She put tons of money into it. The value for a small house, less than probably about a third of the size of ours, was going to be $1.5 million. The bank would never agree to it. The building department and the bank never could get together. She never did build her house. She worked on it for 20 years, probably something like that. So she never got her little concrete terrorist structure built.
I've heard about 15 stories like this where people were like going to do something interesting, and then they tried to work with the government. And then basically either it took 20 years and it was going over $100,000 just in the amount of money that you just give to the government, not to mention for your own attorneys.
Yeah.
And then it either was never built or it was like in excess of 20 years. And I've heard of a few eco buildings going into place and they got the authorizations after like 3.5-4 years. They finally got all the I's dotted and T's crossed. But they had to, like, basically it's like not really an eco building anymore. They're being required to build a conventional home that smells a little eco.
Yeah, I prefer just turning them into trespassers and chasing them off or whatever. Actually,
right. So it's, you know, this is, I know when a lot of things we talk about is how can we do this? When you talk about kind of getting out of the rat race and trying to, get like the early retirement extreme stuff, or something like that, then it's kind of like, okay, you lower your monthly expenses, and then it's like, okay, now you're out, and you only have this little bit of money to work with, so how do you get by on the cheap? And it's like, well, you know, if you play ball, and you only buy a conventional home, and you do everything according to the rules, then it's like it's going to be expensive. But if you're willing to live in a smaller place, and this is not a smaller place, this place goes on. There's cubby holes everywhere.
There's 2,200 square feet, I think, and we got bigger rooms because we don't have a bunch of kids hanging around or anything, you know, so
right.
We'll throw them on a couch if we need to or something, but yeah, so.
This place has character. It goes everywhere. It's a myriad of all kinds of interesting things in many, many directions, but, you know, and then sitting, like, we're effectively living in something close to a piece of art. There's been a lot of very beautiful things that we've seen as we're coming in and out of here. And it is, and I think, if nothing else, if you look at a conventional home with those white walls and that are, you know, the what do they call that? Sheetrock. They got the sheetrock, and then they, like, got some mud put together, and they made it make a texture on the wall.
Mud in paper, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Mud in paper.
And then they put a coat of off-white paint on it, and that's your standard house with carpet and baseboard heaters, you know, and it's like, man, that would be hell. Compared to living here.
I work in the cities, and I always feel sorry for those poor people that can't afford anything other than a city house.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I like the idea that a person, you know, built this themselves, and I think you were telling me something like I mean, it's well under $10,000 for this pickup, but you built it yourself.
Say the basic structure, not including all we put into the solar, but the basic structure, $5,000 roughly, plus or minus, I would think.
And most of that's because you brought in logs.
I bought logs from some loggers around here and stuff. One guy gave me 4 loads of them, and he was going to give them to me. I gave him 400 because I didn't feel right about taking them for nothing.
but there, you know, there's a possibility that if you had logs, if you are a property that had lots of logs like this, then would this whole house, 2,200 square feet, would this whole house be like only $2,000?
Yeah, I would say not speeding things up, taking your time, doing it yourself. Cutting your own lumber if you can. If you can get a sawmill. I mean, I had my sawmill before I came up here. But doing it that way, you could do it for next to nothing. I've got one two-story garage that I built out here using things people had given me. I got boat docks that I got for picking up. Two-story garage, it's 14 by 24 with an attic that's not real big, but it's got stuff in it. I built that for $200.
You know, I'm going to throw something in there. There's a phrase that has always bothered me that I've always hated, but in your case, it's actually the opposite. Like I think it actually works, and that is effectively, I'm going to say the word gift economy. So I get people who tell me, oh, the gift economy, you give everything away, and then you receive more than you give. And then I kind of think, I know that you help a lot of neighbors. You just go out and help people because you just, You're a guy who builds and does, and you can't stop yourself. Somebody's like, boy, I could sure use a and then there's Glenn like, hey, you know what? I could build that for you
okay. Just
because I like to and I love you. And then next thing you know, they've got like this mountain of materials over here, and they're like, I want these to go away. And you're like, I have just the place to move them to, my house.
When you're doing something like this, my thing here is, let's quit wasting everything. Let's start using things again. People give me stuff. You need this. You can do something with this, and they feel good about it. Church doors from San Francisco.
Yeah, that's these are beautiful doors.
You need these, Glenn. In the bedroom, I don't know if you noticed it, we've got a signal light from a ship.
I didn't notice that.
When you go into the bathroom.
You know, every room has got, like, something interesting going on.
Yeah, his buddy goes, you need this, Glenn. And then later he gave me 3 more. Then I gave one to another friend that helps me a lot. A building that burned around here during the fire, the tin here. I mean, you go to Bass Pro Shop. They paid hundreds and hundreds or probably thousands and thousands of dollars for burned tin like that, rusted tin. And I got it for nothing. The glass you see in my greenhouse and lots of the windows, all the windows there, here, that was all given to me by the glass shop because they took it out of swimming pools and stuff. It was dual pane. He says, here, just cut the seals out of it, clean it up, and you can use it. He gave it to me. Truckloads. I got 3 truckloads of it. The guy that gave me the logs, he was going to give them to me for free. All the logs that are over our head that are cedar right there, the small beams, 8 to 12 inches diameter, free. I gave him 400 because I didn't feel good about taking 3 loads of logs from him for nothing.
Wow.
This chandelier type thing here, I think it was like $3 at the thrift store, and I painted it black and hooked it up. Yeah, the plywood, a friend of mine, he gets truckloads of this that's tore from peach bins and stuff. He does pay some money for it, for the hauling and stuff, but for me, he said, hey, just take what you need. So,
I guess there you go. My point is that there are ways where the gift economy kind of idea, where I know that you give a lot to your local community, and your local community loves you, and they show their love to you in little bits that end up all over your house and on other little projects you do all the time.
Yeah, we also have some groups that come in from around the world. We take them into the park with a little church over here. And so they are just totally amazed, taking pictures. I've got people that know me in Africa, China, all over the place. Kathy and I take care of them and give them, let them stay in the house for like 3 days. It's the number one thing they want to do. They tell each other. It's the different colleges throughout California and these little groups that get together and come here. And so I've had engineers, students from Korea come through and start documenting, I want to come back and work for free, you know. So they haven't made it back yet, but still they wanted to, you know.
Right, right, right.
So it's teaching things, and I teach for free on country plans, you know, and it's on Glenn's Underground Cabin Update. Get to the first page of country plans. If you go to the bottom right corner, you'll see a hot link going straight to it, to the first page, and you can find it easy that way.
Right.
That's where you'll also find that sign.
And every page on there has pictures.
Yeah.
And it is, and so you start at the very beginning, and you can see the, you know, as the years pass, and there's more and more to it, and all the little different, you know, now I added on this, now I added on that, and there's another little piece, and then this. And then there's, I remember one is like, okay, well, look at this post that rotted, and here's how you tell it rotted. Look at this. And then it's like, and then here's how we decided to take a post out of the middle of an existing ailer structure and replace it with a good post. And it's like, wow, that was brilliant. That was hard work, and you got it done.
And as you go through, you'll learn different things, too. Now, you're going to find at the end we're running it more as a blog, so it's things that happen here, too, or things we're doing here, homesteading stuff, the visitors we brought through from different places and stuff. There's some interviews with some of them.
At one point you had a goat.
Yeah, the goat was right up there. In a short few months after that, a mountain lion got a hold of her, and that was the end of her. But,
right.
Yeah.
And that's part of the story that's in there.
She was the inspector, right. She
the inspector.
She was up looking at my stuff.
Seemed to always be involved in whatever
yeah.
you were doing with building this
yeah.
place.
We couldn't keep her in, and eventually she taught the sheep how to get out, and then we really had trouble.
So all these stories, just as the years pass, of all these different things, the thread is just like, it's just amazing. It just goes on and on and on. And every page has pictures of stuff, because I know that like from page 50 through 100, I think I was just looking at the pictures.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm set up now where I started with computers when Al Gore invented the internet, so I'm way back there. I was one of the when we were still.
So you must know Al
together. I know a lot about it, and I kind of like the technology junk. You know, I've got the new Samsung Note. Phone that's also a small computer, and I can actually take pictures, send them straight to PhotoBucket, post them right into country plans from my phone. So that, a lot of that happens now too.
Oh my. Okay. Well, Glenn, it's awesome being here. Do you have anything else that you want to add to tell my pod people?
Well, about the only thing I could say is if you want to do it, just do it.
I think that's one of the things that Ehler points out in his book, is that his design is so that a person by themselves can build a home, and that this is a design that is very good for somebody who doesn't know how to build a home.
Yeah, it's very flexible. You need to study, see what his ideas are. I recommend getting his used to be tapes. I think it's CDs now.
He's got DVDs.
DVDs,
I know
DVDs. Okay.
A three DVD set that he sells for like $100.
Yeah, if you're serious on doing it, then you're going to learn a lot more there.
I think the first and second DVD are going to give you a lot of information on how to build this kind of structure, especially getting light from four different directions. And then the third DVD has to do with, like, how to build a shelter against nuclear attack or something like that.
Yeah, we may still need that, but what the heck, you know, they've got our coordinates now from the last census, and so expect a drone strike any day, you know.
Drone strike. You think we're going to end by drone strike?
Yeah, that's okay. Why they wanted our coordinates of our front doors at the census.
Oh, my. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
okay.
See, now you know it all.
Oh, damn. Now I can be even more scared. So, all right.
I walked them out at the front gate.
That's right.
They never made it.
They didn't pay the $5,000 a day.
There's a pole that goes across the road down there to start. It swings in and closes the
I did.
Gate.
I saw that.
It was closed.
So the census people couldn't get past your gate.
Every time they left it on the gate.
So the drone's going to attack your
gate.
Well,
they know there's a crazy guy with guns and a tractor up here. That's what the fire people said.
It's a good message to pass along, crazy people.
Yeah.
All right, anything else to add?
I think that's about it for now, as far as I can think of.
If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com. Well, and you can go to, you know, countryplans.com,
yeah.
too.
We'll answer questions there, too.
Yeah. It's a nice forum. I like it. So come on out to our forums, where we talk about homesteading and permaculture all the time.